from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Martin Indyk has been at the center of U.S. diplomacy in the Middle East for decades. He's served as a U.S. ambassador to Israel, a special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, an advisor to presidents, an assistant secretary of state for Near Eastern affairs. He's stood next to presidents and world leaders, negotiated peace, brokered the United States' role in the Middle East. But now, after that decades-long career, he's had a stark change of heart. He says he's lost hope in Washington's, quote, quixotic efforts in the Middle East. He says it's time for a major reassessment of America's role and ambitions there. So this hour on Point, a diplomat's heartbreak and his advice for a new way forward in the Middle East. And Martin Indyk joins us today from New York. Currently, he's a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He recently authored an op-ed that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. It's headlined, "The Middle East Isn't Worth It Anymore." Ambassador Indyk, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Nice to be with you.
Heartbreak. Why are you feeling heartbreak right now about America and the Middle East?
Yeah, well, I'm not feeling heartbreak at the moment, but I will admit that my heart has been broken at least three times. And that was because I came to the Middle East via the Arab-Israeli conflict and the belief that the United States had a critical role to play in resolving that conflict. And indeed, I've devoted my entire professional career to that proposition. I'm studying, writing about, and then practicing the art of American peacemaking diplomacy in the Middle East. And it's not as if we didn't have some successes along the way, but in the end, we were unable, after repeated efforts, to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think that's what has been heartbreaking for me.
Well, if I may, I just want to quote directly from what you wrote in the journal. You wrote, "Arab-Israeli peacemaking has captivated me for my entire professional life. Yet it has been more than 20 years since the last U.S.-brokered Israeli-Palestinian agreement was signed, the Y River Memorandum, in 1998. And the task is now clearly hopeless." So that is not you saying we need to adjust our approach, or we need new negotiators, or we need a new plan. You're saying the task, the fundamental task, is hopeless. Why?
This is a judgment that I reached after serving as President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry's envoy for the last negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians on final status issues, which was back in 2013-2014, ended in 2014. And sad to say, parties were further apart at the end of those negotiations than they were at the beginning. And I think that that taught me that, as I say, as long as we have the current leaders on both sides in control, that is to say, Netanyahu on the Israeli side and Abu Mazen on the Palestinian side, the task is hopeless. There is no way to bridge the deep gap of mistrust amongst the leaders and amongst the people in the intentions and motivations of the other. And the United States doesn't have the ability to do that, certainly doesn't have the ability to do it by putting down a plan that was devised in Washington without any consultation with one side, such as President Trump has now done.
Well, I was just about to say that, yeah, that is exactly the approach the U.S. is continuing under this administration, right, as you're pointing out. If I may, Ambassador, I'd actually, you know, to your point about how far apart Israeli and Palestinian leaders are, I'd just like to play a little bit of tape from the latest Middle East peace plan from the Trump administration was announced. So first of all, on January 28th, President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did jointly announce the new Middle East peace plan. As Ambassador Indyk noted, Palestinian leaders weren't consulted and they were not present for the announcement. But here is Prime Minister Netanyahu.
"Since the moment of its birth, Israel has yearned for peace with our Palestinian neighbors and peace with the broader Arab world. For decades, that peace has proved elusive. Despite so many well-intentioned plans, one after the other, they failed. Why did they fail? They failed because they did not strike the right balance between Israel's vital security and national interests and the Palestinians' aspirations for self-determination.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, on January 28th. Well, just last week, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas did speak. I should say just earlier this week, he was before the United Nations Security Council expressing his frustration with the plan. And he held up a map of the proposed future Palestinian state and explained why he believes the plan is unacceptable.
Here is the summary of the project which was presented. Here is what we expect as a state. It looks like Swiss cheese. Who among you would accept such a situation?
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas earlier this week. Ambassador Indyk, yes, clearly the sides are as far apart as ever. But you just said that the United States does not have the ability to bridge that gap. Why is that? Is that something fundamental about the U.S. or something fundamental about the situation in the Middle East?
Well, it's something fundamental about the conflict. In the end, the peace has to be made between the parties involved in the conflict. The United States can at best be an honest broker and a mediator and can support the parties, underwrite their risks if they're prepared to take risks for peace, as Israeli and Palestinian leaders have been prepared in the past. But there's no risk-taking involved in a plan for the Israelis that meets all their security requirements, which I think is important, but also meets all their other requirements and doesn't take into account Palestinian concerns. So it's easy to make peace between the United States and Israel, but that's not the purpose of the exercise. That doesn't end the conflict. And that's all that the Trump plan has done. Mm-hmm. So I think the essence of it is, how do you actually bridge the gap between the parties? The United States can put forward ideas based on their knowledge of their positions and their flexibility. But you can't do it simply by agreeing with one side on what their needs are and then turning around and trying to impose it on the other. The United States doesn't have the ability to bludgeon the Palestinians into saying yes. The one advantage they have in their immense weakness is the ability to say no. And that's exactly what they're saying.
Well, we are talking with Ambassador Martin Indyk this hour about his recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where he calls for the United States to end its, quote, quixotic efforts in the Middle East. And he's asking for the nation to pursue a new way forward. So what's your question for Ambassador Indyk? So Ambassador Indyk, really, it seems to me the fundamental purpose of what you wrote in the Wall Street Journal is this. It's to acknowledge, to get more people in Washington to acknowledge that you see U.S. interests, fundamental interests in the Middle East have changed. So what has changed?
Yeah, well, first of all, the old conception of American interests, which has lasted for about four decades, essentially since the 1973 Arab-Israeli war, known as the Yom Kippur War, after which the United States moved into a position of dominance in the region. And the basic definition of our interests from that time until recently has been an interest in the survival and security of the state of Israel, our democratic ally there, and maintaining the ability to protect the free flow of oil from the region at reasonable prices. Those have been the two fundamental interests that we have identified and indeed gone to war and invested a huge treasure of blood and money and also our prestige and influence to try to affect and protect and promote those two interests. Resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict was an interest that derived from those two fundamental interests, because if you needed to ensure the free flow of oil, you needed good relations with the Arab world. They were in conflict with Israel. You needed to ensure Israel's security and survival. Therefore, peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors became a derived interest, but nevertheless a vital one in the old regime. Now, today, things have changed dramatically. Israel is no longer a weak, small country that is threatened by its neighbors. It's at peace with Egypt, at peace with Jordan. Those peace treaties have stood the test of time. It is without doubt the strongest military power in the region. It has a strong backing of the United States. Its economy is strong, and high-tech revolution has taken place there. And it is, according to Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister there, a regional superpower.
Mm. But of course, Ambassador, you know better than anyone, it's still sitting in a region where there are local world leaders calling for the destruction or extinction of the Israeli state.
Yes, indeed. That is the case for Iran, whose leaders do it every other week. But that is not the case for the Arab states, who are looking to build their relationships with Israel in order to better protect them from the common threat that they identify with Iran.
Well, Ambassador Martin Indyk, stand by for just a moment, because there's a lot more to dig into in terms of how you see U.S. interests in the region changing. We are talking with Martin Indyk. He's been at the heart of American diplomacy in the Middle East for 40 years, and he's calling for a new way forward. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Ambassador Martin Indyk. He was the U.S. Special Envoy for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in July 2013 to June 2014. Also formerly Ambassador to Israel from 1995 to 1997 and again in 2000 and 2001. He recently wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal headlined, "The Middle East isn't worth it anymore." We have a link to it at onpointradio.org, and we are exploring why Ambassador Indyk says that right now. So Ambassador, if I may, we were just talking about Israeli strength in the region. I just want to dig in a little bit more into that, because you write in your op-ed, quote, "Hard as it is for me to admit it, a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem is not a vital American interest. It is a vital Israeli interest if the country wants to survive as a Jewish and democratic state." So parse the difference there for us. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that it's up to Israel to resolve its fundamental existential dilemma about which is now in front of it, which does it want to be a Jewish and democratic state, or a Jewish state which annexes 30% of the West Bank in the Trump plan, all of the settlements, and ensures that it essentially rules over the Palestinians forever in a way that will create a situation in which millions of Palestinians will eventually become a majority in the land that Israel controls. And therefore, its fundamental democratic identity will become threatened sooner rather than later. So that's a vital decision that Israel has to make in terms of how it separates from the Palestinians rather than continues to rule over them. The Trump plan is a recipe for continued occupation. And that's up to Israel to decide. We if it decides to separate from the Palestinians, then we should certainly be doing everything we can to support them in that, including underwriting the costs of it. But if it seeks to perpetuate its control over the Palestinians through continued occupation, then that's not a vital interest of the United States to do that. It doesn't threaten Israel's survival. It just threatens its identity as a Jewish and democratic state. That's up to Israel to resolve, not up to us.
It's not a vital American interest? I mean, that seems to be a view that's completely opposed to what the common wisdom is in Washington.
Right. Well, I think it's important to understand what I mean by a vital American interest. A vital American interest is one in which we should be ready to go to war for or to invest a huge amount of our energy, prestige, and influence to try to protect and promote. And so, you know, there are two vital interests that we used to have. One was Israel, but Israel now can defend itself by itself. We've helped to give it that capacity. And the other one, which we haven't had a chance to talk about yet, is the question of oil, mm-hmm. and the free flow of oil at reasonable prices. Now, in the days when the Middle Eastern oil dominated the oil market, provided over 50% of its supply, and the United States was heavily dependent on the importation of Middle Eastern oil, we definitely had a vital interest. And that's a vital interest in which we have gone to war over repeatedly, particularly the wars in the Gulf. But today, the United States itself has gone through a oil and natural gas revolution, and we are now an exporter of oil. And will be soon natural gas. And therefore, our interests have shifted. It's true that the economies of China, Japan, South Korea, and to some extent Europe, depend on Middle Eastern oil. And they are our major trading partners, and if supply is cut off to them, it could affect us economically. But that means that we should share responsibility with them for ensuring the free flow of oil to their ports. It should not be the sole responsibility of the American taxpayer to subsidize this, which we've been doing for decades. But now, with the change in the oil market, with oil supply in glut at the moment, with the shift to electric cars, which will eventually significantly reduce the demand for oil, not just in our country, but all over the world, it's time to recognize that we don't have a vital interest there.
Mm.
And therefore, we could, for instance, go to those that do and say, come on, guys, you need to do this together with us. It shouldn't just be an American carrier task force that has to be deployed to the Gulf to protect their oil flow. They should contribute too, and we should have an international regime that protects this.
Well, I just want to, if I may, play a little bit of tape from last September. This is a moment from 60 Minutes on CBS. They interviewed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman after those drone attacks on those Saudi oil facilities. Nora O'Donnell asked Salman about the attacks.
This attack hit the heart of Saudi Arabia's oil industry. Were you blindsided?
I might disagree with you. This attack didn't hit the heart of the Saudi energy industry, but rather the heart of the global energy industry. It disrupted 5.5% of the world's energy needs, the needs of the U.S. and China and the whole world.
That's Mohammed bin Salman on 60 Minutes last September. Martin Indyk, the reason why I wanted to play that is to your point of you hear the Saudis right there still putting themselves at the heart of the global oil industry. Would the Saudis welcome more global distribution of the responsibility to protect those very oil fields, as you're saying, or do they prefer having America take the lead on that?
Well, I think they would prefer America taking the lead if they felt that they could rely on the United States. Mm-hmm. But in the wake of that attack, which took 50% of Saudi Arabia's oil production off the market, you saw several important things, which I think just make my point. First of all, the oil market barely responded. There was barely a blip. In the good old days, when Middle Eastern oil was critical to the oil market, the price of oil would have spiked, would have gone up dramatically. When Saudi Arabia imposed an oil embargo on the United States and some other countries back in 1973, in the context of the Yom Kippur War between Israel, Egypt, and Syria, that led to a quadrupling of oil prices and plunged the world into a global economic recession. That didn't happen this time, and it's not likely to happen in the foreseeable future because of significant fundamental structural changes in the oil market. Now, the second thing that happened was that Donald Trump said, well, it was an attack on their oil fields, not on ours, and raised a big question mark about whether the United States was actually committed to defending Saudi Arabia, a fundamental pact that has been in place since Roosevelt, President Roosevelt met with King Ibn Saud back at the end of the Second World War and forged that pact. So what Trump was reflecting, of course, is the fact that the United States doesn't have the need to go to war for Saudi oil in a way that it was willing to do in the past. Mm-hmm. And so the Saudis can't rely on us, regardless of what is said or whether we send some more forces to Saudi Arabia, which President Trump eventually did. They know that we're no longer a reliable ally when it comes to this issue because of the changes in the oil market, not because of the changes of who's in the White House.
Right. Well, Ambassador Indyk, if I may, I'd like to just pause for a moment. We will come back to your view of what the United or how the United States should change tack. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But I'd like to pause and step back in time because you really have played such a central role in this very issue for so long. I'd love to talk more about how we got here to the way you're feeling now. So first of all, let's go back to 1993. This is September 1993 when Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, then the chairman of the PLO, signed what was known as the Oslo Accords. That was an agreement intended to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You were President Clinton's Middle East advisor at the time, and you helped organize the signing. People might remember that Rabin and Arafat stood on the White House lawn, shook hands. It was quite a historic moment. And Israeli Prime Minister Rabin spoke before the crowd, saying he'd had enough of the conflict.
We who have fought against you, the Palestinians, we say to you today, in a loud and a clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough!
Thank you. Thank you.
And that thank you is the voice of Yasser Arafat. This was 1993. Martin Indyk, you were actually in the Oval Office just prior to that historic moment. Take us back to that moment. What was it like in the Oval Office? What were these men discussing just before they stepped outside before the world's cameras?
Well, before they came in, we had to brief President Clinton. And the big concern at that point was whether Arafat would try to kiss Rabin, because he was a big kisser, and whether he'd try to kiss Clinton. So we were busily training Clinton on a special arm lock to prevent that from happening. And I actually have a picture of that little exercise. But in any case, there was no kissing, but there was a handshake, and there was some question about whether there was going to be a handshake. And I was called out of a briefing with the president in the Oval Office with an urgent call from Rabin's chief of staff to say that since Arafat was wearing a uniform and Rabin had an understanding that he was going to be wearing a suit, not a uniform, Rabin wasn't coming. So we had to resolve that last-minute crisis when the Saudi ambassador was riding with Arafat, told me, no, it's not a uniform, it's a safari suit. And so Rabin came after all. They all assembled in the blue room, and that was the first time that Arafat and Rabin had met each other. It's the first time that Clinton had met Arafat. And so it was a very tense situation. Arafat was in his element. He had a big, beaming smile on his face. He couldn't believe that he was actually in the White House. But for everybody else, it was a very kind of uncertain moment as to how this was all going to work out. And when Rabin and Arafat stood next to Clinton waiting for the announcement there, you know, that they were coming out to sign it, Rabin turned to Arafat and he just said, "We have a lot of work to do, Mr. Chairman." That kind of summarized the seriousness of that moment right before they did the deal and shook hands and there was no kissing.
Mm-hmm. You know, hearing that tape of Rabin saying, "We've had enough blood and tears." That was 1993. And yet here we still are in 2020, not having made any progress, as you're saying, Ambassador Indyk. So if the 2020 Martin Indyk could go back and talk to the 1993 Martin Indyk, is there anything that you would advise your younger self to do differently?
Sure. I've thought about that question a lot. I wrote a book about it too. Look, I think first of all, I want to just go with this question of no progress. That's not true. The Oslo Accords that were signed on that day on the South Lawn of the White House actually did some very important things. And we quickly forget all of that because of what happened afterwards. They did provide for the Palestinians to take control of 40% of the West Bank, all of Gaza, to build institutions of governance, which they did not have before, that are not fully accountable and fully transparent, but by Middle Eastern standards, they're pretty good. And we helped them build a security force in collaboration with Israel that is now working hand in glove with the Israeli security forces to maintain order in the West Bank. And all of that was to lay the foundations for a Palestinian state, an independent Palestinian state. And those institutions exist and those security forces exist and they will eventually, I believe, but probably not in my lifetime, serve as the basis for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Now, to your question, what do we learn? I think the most important thing that we learn is that it's really important for both sides to live up to the commitments that they make. In the case of the Oslo Accords, which were negotiated directly between the Israelis and Palestinians, actually behind the back of the United States, there were commitments on the Palestinian part to renounce terror and prevent acts of terror, and there were commitments on the Israeli side not to take unilateral acts like settlement activity in the West Bank. Now, I don't mean to suggest that these are moral equivalents, but the reality was both sides observe their commitments in the breach. And that helped to undermine the confidence of the people in the deal that was being struck. And in the end, when we went for the final deal, when President Clinton brought Arafat and against his will to Camp David, together with then Prime Minister Ehud Barak, I think that the ground was not properly prepared in terms of both sides' willingness and ability to live up to their commitments. And so there was a great deal of distrust already by that time. Arafat thought that he was being cornered by Clinton and Barak and that they were trying to impose an agreement on him, just like Netanyahu and Trump are trying to do now. And he decided to break out. Unfortunately, he also decided to allow Palestinian frustration to express itself in violence, and that led to the Intifada, which caused immense loss of life on both sides. It raged for 5 years and destroyed all of the trust between the people. And it's proven impossible to rebuild the trust since then.
Martin Indyk, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. So I'm just going to ask a question and maybe hear your answer on the other side of the break. But So this issue of trust between the people, between the negotiators, between the leaders seems to be central in your answer. So when we come back, I'm going to ask you again, if you were speaking to the younger Martin Indyk from 1993, what would you have advised that the U.S. do, since it was leading negotiations mostly, to build that trust between those people at that time? So stand by for just a moment, Ambassador Indyk. We're talking to Martin Indyk. He's recently written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal headlined, "The Middle East Isn't Worth It Anymore." Lots more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Ambassador Martin Indyk. For several decades, he's been at the heart of U.S. diplomatic efforts in the Middle East. And he recently wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal headlined, "The Middle East Isn't Worth It Anymore." Ambassador Indyk, before the break, I was asking you specifically, given who Rabin was, given who Arafat was, given who Bill Clinton was, is there anything you would have done differently or advised differently to build trust actually between those men themselves?
Well, we're going to want to go back to there. There was trust between Arafat and Rabin. They did build trust between themselves. They had an understanding. They had a back channel that engaged in secret communications between the two of them. Arafat went out of his way to accommodate some of Rabin's political concerns because Rabin had organized for Arafat to have what Rabin called walking around money and had in several ways made it clear to Arafat that he was cognizant and sensitive to Arafat's political needs. And so by the end there, before Rabin was assassinated, they really did have trust and understanding. Arafat called Rabin his peace partner. But once Rabin was assassinated and then Netanyahu became prime minister, the trust evaporated very quickly. Netanyahu was elected on an anti-Oslo platform and did his best to resist going ahead with implementation of Oslo, dragging his feet. Eventually agreeing to give up 13% of the West Bank, and that brought down his government. And then Barak came to power, and Barak basically sought to corner Arafat, make him a generous offer, and have Clinton impose it on him, and Arafat wouldn't go along. So, I mean, that trust broke down very quickly after Rabin's assassination.
It sounds like it sounds like the actual relationships between these individuals, between these leaders, really did and does make a difference in the diplomatic processes.
Totally. Look, it takes three to tango in the Arab-Israeli conflict resolution, the first two dances are critical. That is, the Israeli and Palestinian or Arab. When you had Sadat and Begin, two leaders who were willing to make far-reaching compromises and commit their people and bring their people around to support it, you had peace between Israel and Egypt. When you had Rabin and King Hussein, you had peace between Israel and Jordan. When you've got Netanyahu and Abu Mazen, you don't have the leaders who are capable – or willing, for one reason or another, to take the kinds of risks necessary to make peace, to treat each other in such a way as to build trust between them. Netanyahu constantly denigrates Abu Mazen as a terrorist, an inciter of terrorism, and that naturally doesn't produce a positive reaction on the other side. Mm. And Abu Mazen, on the other hand, you know, he's in the 14th year of his 4-year term. He doesn't have a mandate from his people. His polity is split between Gaza and the West Bank, between his party Fatah and Hamas. He's in a very weak position, and he fears his people, and so he's not prepared to take the risks either. And so, if you don't have the leaders willing to lead their people to peace, to convince their people to make the necessary compromises, and the people don't trust each other's intentions because of the intifada and the death and destruction that has taken place and because of the settlement activity that has taken place since then, it neither comes from the top nor from the bottom. There's no pressure on the leaders to make peace and no willingness of the leaders themselves to take the risks. In that environment, the notion that the United States can put down a plan and expect somehow that both sides are going to endorse it and embrace it is just fanciful.
Right. Well, let's see if we can at least get one call in here. Our callers have been very patient this hour, Ambassador Indyk. So let's go to Omar, who's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Omar, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Ambassador makes a lot of salient points with regards to oil, security, Oslo, Madrid, but and United States exporting, being an exporter of oil. But one thing that the United States did use to export, and that's democracy, freedom, and a self-determination. And what you have now in the occupied territories, it's the longest occupation in the history of the world. And what the Palestinians are expected to negotiate for is 9% of historical Palestine. And so in this, they've annexed the Golan. They're going to annex the entire Jordan Valley and set up a system of bridges and tunnels to institutionalize apartheid. And my point is that I think we have passed that point now, that that's an impossibility, and that in fact a one-state solution is possible, because as Ambassador Indyk said, the way that this plan is set up, which I might say is dead on arrival in most corners of the world, will only fuel more discord, distrust, and violence on both sides, because there is violence on both sides. And if they keep in place the military law that governs life in the West Bank and institutionalizes this new peace plan, it's going to be impossible.
Right. Omar, thank you so much for that call. Ambassador Indyk, would you like to respond to him?
Well, I think he too makes some good points. And I don't believe that a one-state solution is any more viable than the solution that's being presented at the moment in the Trump plan. I do think that in the end, the parties will eventually, after exhausting all the other possibilities, come around to the reality that the only way to live together is, first of all, to separate into two independent states living alongside each other in peace. But at the moment, the conditions, as I've said all along, aren't ripe for that. The notion, however, that Israel is somehow going to agree to equal rights for Palestinians in a way that turns the Jewish state into a binational state is also fanciful. Israel's just not going to do that. The word apartheid has been used a lot, and I've avoided using it at all because I don't believe that Israel is pursuing an apartheid policy, has a philosophy of apartheid like the South African regime had. Far from it. But I do think that one of the multiple ironies of the Trump plan is that it is, in fact, creating an apartheid-like situation in which the map, and I urge everybody to go and look at it because it's online on whitehouse.gov, the map essentially creates Bantustan, where Israeli territory surrounds these cantons, which are separated by settlements and connected by roads and tunnels to provide what you might call transportational contiguity, but not territorial contiguity, which is fundamental to the viability of an independent state. So, you know, ironically, you have a situation, an apartheid-like situation that would be created if the Trump plan were ever to be implemented.
If I may, Ambassador, yes, it is the Trump plan, but as we noted earlier, it has the full support of Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Yes, and you know, that's fine, but the support, in the sense that you've got to have Israel supporting it, Israel controls the territory, it has to give up territory, there's to be any solution.
But I suppose I just make that point because we have the Israeli prime minister supporting what you're calling the creation of Bantustans for the Palestinian people. That's the what I just wanted to sort of highlight for a moment.
Yeah, right. I mean, but why wouldn't you, if you were the Israeli prime minister, take America's largesse? Except it's not America's to give. But why wouldn't you go for it if Trump is prepared to give it? But you see, what Netanyahu did was he traded an agreement to an independent Palestinian state with its capital supposedly in East Jerusalem, although Trump people call it Eastern Jerusalem. We can get into that if you like, but it's not East Jerusalem. But he traded that in principle for Trump's willingness to have Israel annex, independent of the actual negotiations, 30% of the West Bank, all of the settlements, all of the Jordan Valley, and all of the old city, the Muslim and Christian quarters there, the Haram al-Sharif, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, all of that is, and all of the major Arab suburbs in Israel, all of that is going to be part of Israel, according to the Trump plan. And so Netanyahu was willing to accept the principle in exchange for the promise of being able to annex this territory.
Well, you know, Ambassador, we've only got about 5 minutes left here, and I want to look forward with you as well, because we've talked about, you know, your view that vital American interests in the region have changed vis-a-vis the Israeli state, vis-a-vis the importance of Middle East oil. I mean, you, in your piece in The Wall Street Journal, you also touch upon other issues as well. Iran nuclear containment, very important. The impact that an unresolved Middle East peace has on terrorism and counterterrorism and the Islamic State. Those are major issues, too. I just want to acknowledge them. But fundamentally, you have called American efforts in the past, under the past several administrations, quixotic. And you say we need a sustainable Middle East strategy based on a more realistic assessment of our interests. So what is that strategy? What is the way forward? And does the United States lead on that strategy?
Look, I think the most important thing is that we have to downsize our ambitions and bring them into a meaningful relationship with the resources we're prepared to commit to them. So, the extreme example is, on the one hand, the Trump administration says they want to remove every Iranian boot from Syria, at the same time as they are committed to removing every American boot from Syria. So we don't have the means of achieving an objective. Don't declare an objective that we're not going to put the means up to achieve. And the most important point there is, let's stop seeking regime change as an objective in the Middle East. We don't have the means to achieve it. If we do achieve it, it turns out to be a disaster for our own interests in the region. We should learn from past mistakes that kind of grandiosity is doesn't serve our interests and is beyond our means to achieve it. So let's bring our objectives and our means into some more realistic relationship.
Okay. So
that is, I think, the most important point.
So, Ambassador, though, I wonder, when given what you just said and what you wrote in your Wall Street Journal piece where you said that it's time to eschew never-ending wars and grandiose objectives like pushing Iran out of Syria, overthrowing the Ayatollahs, or, in your words, resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So you want to put those aside in favor of more limited goals. But I wonder, regarding that Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is lowering American ambitions in the region, is that turning our back on a moral obligation we might have to the Israeli, Palestinian, and Palestinian people to broker a kind of lasting peace there? Does the United States not have that obligation?
Yeah, I say specifically in the article that we should not turn our backs on the Middle East, and we should not turn our backs on the Israelis and the Palestinians either. But it's up to them to make peace. And it's up to us to support them, to encourage them, but not to imagine that we can somehow devise a peace and impose it on them, on one side or the other. And that's the critical difference. They need to be the ones to take the lead. And it may well be after the upcoming Israeli election that we'll have a prime minister and a government that's not Netanyahu and not annexationist, and we'll reach out to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians may just feel desperate enough to respond, and they could get talks going again, and we could come in and support them, not with the Trump plan, but with whatever it is that they say they need from us. That's the difference between the way that we are pursuing peace at the moment, which is, as I say, is a farce, and the way that we should pursue peace when the two sides are ready to engage with each other.
So how are they going to get there? I mean, you say it seems as if you're saying the United States isn't going to be, shouldn't be the broker that gets them there. I mean, especially because you say the U.S. has this unique mix of innocence and arrogance. So can the rest of the world afford to wait for the Israelis and Palestinians to get there themselves?
Oh, yes. Look, the rest of the world is leaving the Palestinian issue behind. Mm. And the Arabs are at the head of the march in that regard. The Palestinian issue is no longer the core of conflict and instability in the region. There are far bigger problems that the region has to confront. But it is a problem, as I say, an existential problem for Israel. And it's a problem for the Palestinians. So it's about time that they dealt with each other. And then we should come in and help them make the peace when they're ready to do it.
Well, Martin Indyk was U.S. Special Envoy for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in 2013 and 2014, served as U.S. Ambassador to Israel in 1995 to 1997, and again in 2000 and 2001. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. His Wall Street Journal op-ed is titled, "The Middle East Isn't Worth It Anymore." We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Ambassador Indyk, thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you, Meghna, for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.